Kids today grow up with a wave of chemicals never experienced by any human generation before. From the exhaust pipes, from their own car seats, from all sorts of chemicals in the food, pesticides around them. How bad is it? Well, let's find out what the scientists know from Dr. Philip Landergan in a lecture given to the Harvard Medical School in February 2006 entitled Children's Chemical Burden.
Phil Landergan has a very interesting pedigree. He trained here at the medical school and in pediatrics at Children's Hospital down the street. But not only has he been in academia, and he's currently the chair of a community medicine at Mount Sinai School of Medicine, but he also was in government for many years and ran one of the major health evaluation branches of the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health. So he really has familiarity with both ends of the age spectrum and brings to this talk an appreciation not only of children's issues but also how they may actually manifest themselves as they grow older. Phil's also been involved in international work all around the world and is still traveling as part of his U.S. Public Health Service duties and his national reserves that he'll tell you about, hopefully, that have given him a wonderful global perspective. But I think what he's known about most in the environmental health community is working in the Clinton administration and Carol Browner to create a whole office of children's environmental health and the recognition that children are not just little adults. The way that they're exposed, the way that they respond to environmental threats is much different, and we have to get a handle on that. And for that, we can really thank and greet Phil Landergan.
So I think too many people in the environmental movement generally and within our field of environmental medicine talk endlessly about the problems and not enough about solutions. And I've always thought it was important to write a prescription after you make the diagnosis. And so I'm going to try to cover both, time permitting. So let's start by thinking about what is the environment. You know, typically in this country, because we've got a pretty nice lifestyle, most of us, we tend to think of the environment as being things like what Howard just talked about, the heavy metals or air pollution. And we forget that really, the taken broadly, the environment is a lot more than toxic chemicals. It's the whole of everything that surrounds us. Some folks, in fact, have said that the environment is everything that's not DNA, and then they're not sure about that. And so one of the very useful diagrams that I've seen describing the environment puts DNA in the center of a series of concentric circles, and then around that you've got the small intimate circle of the toxic chemicals that can get right in and damage DNA. A broader environment around that is family, community, society, and the whole planet. And the environment at every one of those levels can influence health. One of the macroscopic ways to look at the environment and to look at its effect on health is to look at the big changes that occur when nations go through industrial development, when they pass through what has been termed the epidemiologic transition from a situation in which the primary drivers of disease and death are the infectious disease. They transition to a situation such as we have in this country, such as pertains in Japan or Western Europe, where the principal drivers of disease and death are the chronic diseases. And we went through it in this country. This is a graph from the Office of the Health Commissioner in New York City, and similar data would apply for Boston or Philadelphia or any of the bigger, older U.S. cities. And it depicts the time span from 1800 till almost the present. And the jagged line that runs across the slide is the crude mortality rate, the number of deaths per 1,000 people per year. So you can see, starting back here in 1800 compared to 1980, the death rate was almost twice as high. What's that mean? People died twice? No. It means they lived half as long. It means that per 1,000 people, there were twice as many deaths per year because life expectancy at birth was something like 40 years. There was a great deal of death in infancy. There was a lot of maternal death in childbirth. There were a lot of kids who died. All you've got to do to illustrate that to yourself is go visit one of the lovely old graveyards that are so abundant around Boston and look at the date of death, or the elapsed years recorded on the gravestone. People didn't live very long. Sure, there were folks like Ben Franklin, but he was the exception. So superimposed upon that high background of mortality were all these spikes as the big infections rolled through. This one here is of personal interest, the cholera epidemic of the 1840s, because that came from Ireland when my ancestors and some of yours came over on what were called the coffin ships, the ships that were full of dead bodies from Ireland during the potato famine. They brought cholera with them, and it caused a huge outbreaks of disease here in Boston, in Montreal, in New York, in Philly, in New Orleans, and all the cities where Irish immigrants landed. Thanks very much. And then it's interesting that in 1860, about right after the Civil War, mortality began to come down. And why do you think that was? Was that the year that penicillin was invented? Was that the year that heart transplants were pioneered and made available on a mass basis? What happened in 1860 that caused the decline in mortality? Water. Clean water, sewage disposal, decent housing. What, if you had to use a generic term to describe those improvements, what would that term be? Huh?
Sanitation.
Sanitation is one good word. What's another one? Hygiene's another. What's the third? How about change in the environment? As opposed to, this was not modern medicine. Penicillin came in about here, 1939, 1940, sulfa drugs a few years earlier. Heart transplants about here. So clearly all the stuff that drives us all so crazy when we walk through the wards of a place like the Brigham was not what accounts for most of the reduction in mortality that has occurred in this society. And that's, it's when I speak to medical students, it's important to point out that probably engineers have saved a lot more lives than we of the second oldest profession. So these are the big diseases that pertain today. Asthma has become the leading cause of admission of U.S. children to hospital. Cancer, you don't typically think of cancer as a childhood disease, but it is. It's about 8,000 new cases per year in this country. And cancer is the second leading cause of death in American children beyond the first year of life. In the first year of life, it's all sorts of neonatal stuff. But once you get beyond the first birthday, the leading cause of death is injuries, accidents, violence taken collectively. And number two is cancer. And let me show you some statistics on these. So here are the stats on asthma coming from the CDC. And rates have been going up steadily for several decades. We'll talk about causes in a few minutes, but this is the pattern. Childhood cancer, the good news is the declining mortality. When I was a resident, after I graduated from here and I was over at Children's doing my residency in pediatrics, I spent a month or two in the dead of winter, probably the darkest month of my life, working on the Jimmy Fund ward, the childhood cancer ward. All the kids with cancer were on a single floor at Children's in those days. I'm not sure if that's the case today or not, but all the kids were there. And the terrible thing about the Children's Cancer Ward 35 years ago was that every kid died. There were no remissions. There were no cures. There were remissions, but there were no cures. And the best you could do was hope for a remission that might last for a few months to, quote, give the family time to get used to the fact that the kid was going to pass away. Nobody got out of there. And that's all changed. Two-thirds of kids with leukemia now survive. Some get other diseases later on in life as a consequence of the treatments, and the treatment itself is miserable, but they do live. The bad news, though, is that the incidence, that's a rate, not just a raw number, the incidence rate has been going up at the rate of 1-2% per year steadily now since we started keeping national statistics in the 70s. And so the aggregate increase has been about 30% for leukemia, which is the most common childhood cancer, and about 40% for primary brain tumor, which is the second most common. Testicular cancer, which is a disease not of kids but of young men after puberty, basically teens, 20s, and into the 30s, and then it sort of fades. And this has gone up in white men, though not in blacks, by 65%. Huge increase. Everybody knows about Lance Armstrong, but what folks don't realize is that he's just one of the most prominent members of this cohort. Hypospadias, some of you won't know what this is. This is a birth defect of the genital organs in baby boys, and it's a diagnosis that's quite easily made in the newborn nursery. What happens is the urethra, the urine tube, is short. And so when you look at the little boy's penis, when you do the examination in the newborn nursery, the opening is not out at the tip, but back along the underside. And some are back just a little ways, and the worst ones are way back at the base and require multiple rounds of surgery to correct. And in the case of going back to the cancer one for a second, there's been some debate here as to whether it's better diagnosis, but nobody thinks this is better diagnosis. This is a very obvious and easy condition to recognize, and the trend is quite remarkable. And developmental disabilities, Howard, of course, touched upon this topic in his discussion of lead and other metals. There's been a lot of debate, and there may be some reality to the notion that these conditions are increasing in frequency. There's certainly been a lot of talk about rising rates of autism and attention deficit disorder. The data to either support or refute that position are pretty weak because we don't keep statistics on them. But whether the rates are rising or not, these are very common diseases. There are about 4 million babies born each year in this country. So just too simple mental arithmetic, somewhere between 3 and 8% of 4 million babies is between 120,000 and perhaps as many as 400,000 kids born each year in this country with these sorts of problems. And that's a lot of kids. It's a lot of school failure. It's a lot of special ed. It's a lot of diminished economic productivity over the entire lifetime for those kids. It's a huge burden upon society. So anything that we could do to find preventable causes of those diseases and do something about them is going to be a great triumph for preventive medicine. And obesity. Obesity is just, no pun intended, becoming a huge problem. My hospital in New York City, Mount Sinai Hospital, is located in East Harlem, which is a pretty much predominantly 98% minority neighborhood and poor. The median family income is about $9,000. In poor communities like East Harlem, what do you think is the rate of obesity among little five-year-old children entering kindergarten? We did a survey last year, so I've got a good number to give you in a minute, but take a guess at it.
40%.
Huh? 40. Yeah, 41. So quite amazing. Quite amazing. It's just an amazing problem. And when you think of the downstream consequences that I've listed here of obesity, cardiovascular disease, stroke, possibly increased risk of cancer, and worst of all, the appearance even in childhood of type 2 diabetes, which we used to call adult onset diabetes, it's really quite frightening. So this is the central question, I think. This is what our research focuses on. This is what I'm going to be talking with you about now going forward. What is the evidence that toxic chemicals in the environment are contributing to the causation of disease in children? This is a very important question to answer, not just for theoretical purposes, but because most all of the chemicals that we're worried about are man-made chemicals. There are synthetic chemicals. They're in the environment because people undertook some kind of commercial activity and put them there. And so what that means, the obvious corollary to that, is that if you can identify what chemicals are causing disease, you can prevent them. And that's the focus of the exercise. I also deliberately use this picture as the backdrop. Those of you who have good eyes can see that these two kids are bathing in a barrel that used to be a pesticide drum. Hopefully there's no pesticide in there now, just water. But it used to contain something called meth, which does not sound like a health potion. So this is what we know about chemicals in kids' health. We know that there are a lot of chemicals out there. We know that the majority have never been tested to see if they can cause toxicity. And we know, and I'll go into the details in a moment, that kids are more vulnerable to these chemicals than adults. So here are the data on chemical production. Chemical production has just skyrocketed in the past 40 or 50 years. When I was an intern, which was 67, the movie came out, The Graduate. And you remember that famous line in there where the cuckolded husband was counseling the young man who was having the affair with his wife, and he said, "Son, the future is in plastics." And that was here on the curve. I guess he was right. So, and these are the numbers of chemicals that are actually out there. There are now more than 80,000 chemicals registered for commercial use in this country with EPA, in Europe with the OECD. And the ones that really matter are the ones that are produced in high volume. So there's about 3,000 that are produced in quantities of more than 1 million pounds per year, and there's about 15,000 in the next tier down that are produced between 100,000 and 1 million pounds per year. Those are the ones that are most widely distributed. They're in consumer products, they're in communities, they're in schools. And, of course, a lot of them have been extremely useful. They include antibiotics, they include cancer chemotherapy drugs, they include the chemicals that go into jet fuel, which is why I'm here today and not still walking through Connecticut. It's the building materials, it's the cosmetics, it's all kinds of stuff that helps make our life better. So I don't think we should go back to the 1900s. It's not the fact that it's not the chemical revolution per se that's the problem. The problem is how we have managed, or more precisely, how we failed to manage the chemical revolution. And the thing that really worries me most is the fact that we just haven't tested stuff. We make them, we use them, we put them into products, and then hope that nothing is going to go wrong, and then react in horror 5 or 10 years later when something does go wrong. And I'll give you some examples of that in a few minutes. Now, I mentioned that children are more vulnerable, and these are some of the reasons why. There was a committee at the National Academy of Sciences that went into this in great detail and published their report called Pesticides in the Diets of Infants and Children. And they were focusing on pesticides, but the lessons go beyond that. The first thing is greater exposure. Compared to adults, children have just much more exposure per pound or per kilogram of body weight. A baby in the first year of life consumes 7 times as much water per pound as we do, 7 times. So if that baby is in the Midwest and it's springtime and the drinking water supply is full of the atrazine that's just been applied to the cornfields out there as a pre-planting herbicide, would have been done last month, that baby is getting 7 times as much atrazine into her body as you or I would. And that's a huge hit for a chemical that has some distinct toxic effects. And then you put that together with the fact that children's enzymatic machinery is immature. They can't break down the chemicals, and so the chemicals hang around much longer in their bloodstream. Organophosphate pesticides, for example, last 6 or 7 times longer in an infant than in you or me. And kids are going through development. Their brains, their lungs, their kidneys, their immune system, all their organ systems are growing, differentiating, developing. Think of the human brain. In embryonic life, in the first couple of weeks after conception, the nervous system is a strip of cells along the dorsal surface of the embryo. And then over the next 4 or 5 months, that strip of a couple of dozen cells evolves into a complex organ consisting of several billion cells. And every one of those cells is precisely connected to the cells around it. Many of the neurons start in one place, move along a very predefined pathway to their final place in the cerebral cortex or in the cerebellum. As they move, they leave a tail, an axon, behind them. If something like lead gets into the brain of a fetus and prevents the movement of that cell from point A to point B, or if the organophosphate pesticide blocks the formation of the synaptic connections between the cells, well, there's no second chance. Either you make the brain right the first time, or you don't ever get it quite right. And if you don't have it quite right, the consequence is loss of intelligence, alteration of behavior, all the things that Howard was telling you about. So it's terribly important to protect fetuses and little kids, anybody whose brain is still developing, against these kind of things. And then the last reason that kids are so vulnerable is they got a long life to live. And why does that matter? It matters because most chronic disease, whether it's cancer or neurological disease like Parkinson's, most chronic diseases probably develops through stages, through 5 or 6 or 7 sequential mutations or cellular changes that have to occur over time. And it takes a period of time, a so-called latency period, for those changes to occur. Well, if you do the math, and we did the modeling in this National Academy committee, if you calculate that a child sustains 2 or 3 of those hits, of the 6 hits that may be needed, if the child sustains 3 of them in the first year of life, that child's way far already along the curve towards developing disease. And there's been a lot of thought about the possibility that kids who take toxic hits in utero may be at risk for accelerated onset of chronic disease in adult life. The only real way to answer that disturbing question, of course, is to do prospective studies where you actually follow kids for a long period of time, because it's pretty hard to reconstruct exposures after the fact. So here we are. The evidence is coming in. And let's take it by disease. So in the case of asthma, we now know a lot about the causes of asthma. I'll jump ahead for a second and say the two categories of disease for which we know the most about exogenous causation are asthma and other respiratory diseases for one, and learning disabilities for the other. Obesity and cancer were still at a much earlier state of knowledge. But in the case of asthma, we know a lot about the environmental triggers. We know about cockroach droppings. We know about mold and mildew. And in New York, we have been very vigorously going into homes and communities like East Harlem and educating families and landlords how to deal with those toxic triggers. And we actually, in the last 4 years, we're actually seeing a downward trend in asthma, which I think is due mostly to focusing on indoor pollution, because certainly the outdoor air is not getting any better. It was absolutely terrible in Manhattan this morning. What about ambient pollution? That too, there have been some elegant studies. Probably one of the very best was in the New England Journal within the past year by Frank Gouderman and his colleagues in Los Angeles. They did air measurements in 30 or 40 areas of the LA basin that range from quite clean to very dirty. And they found an incredibly tight correlation between levels of air pollution and levels of asthma. But my favorite story is the story of the 1996 Summer Olympics in Atlanta. And what happened that year was that the mayor of Atlanta encouraged the citizens to not drive their cars, but rather to take public transportation to work for the 2 weeks of the games. And his motive was he wanted good, clean air so that the athletes could turn in brilliant times. And Atlantans are not Bostonians. They're certainly not New Yorkers. They're obedient. And they did that. They actually took the trolley and they left their cars at home, and the air did get measurably cleaner. And of course, the athletes did perform brilliantly. But an unexpected byproduct was that hospital admissions, emergency room visits for asthma went way down, stayed down for the 2 weeks of the games, and then came up afterwards. Well, the folks in Detroit had an explanation for that. They said, it's obvious what happened. People were denied the use of their cars, and they suffered at home. The only trouble is that hospital admissions for everything except respiratory disease stayed steady. So I think it was real. And it was been written up. It was published in JAMA. So that means it's almost certainly real. Case of cancer, we certainly know something about preventable causes of cancer. Radiation is one. And after the data were published from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and after Alice Stewart published her data on radiation exposure during diagnostic x-rays during pregnancy, increasing the rate of leukemia. After those papers appeared, the use of x-rays during pregnancy has gone way down, which is clearly a good thing. And there's some hints from the literature about solvents and pesticides, but it's a very murky literature. And the reason that that literature is so unsatisfactory is that the assessment of exposure is, for the most part, lousy. Typically, these studies begin with a group of kids who've already been diagnosed with cancer. Then they take a control group from the same community who don't have cancer, and then they sit the parents down and they try to find out what the parents were exposed to back when they were, during the pregnancy. It's a horrible way to try to ascertain anything unless the exposure is of overwhelming magnitude, because the poor parents who have the child with cancer remember everything that went wrong, and the parents who have a healthy kid say, nothing happened. And it's called recall bias, and it's a normal human phenomenon, and it completely confounds the retrospective attempt to reconstruct exposure. So I think the only way that we're ever going to get a proper handle on environmental causes of childhood cancer are prospective studies that probably begin at least as early as conception, if not before, with huge numbers of kids, because cancer's not that common.
That was Dr. Philip Landrigan speaking at the Harvard Medical School in February 2006 on the topic Children's Chemical Burden, Part 1 of 2. That's the first of two parts of a lecture by Philip Landrigan given to the Harvard Medical School in February 2006 on the topic Children's Chemical Burden. You can watch the full series of lectures in streaming video at chge.med.harvard.edu/education/course_2006.